I think we can get started here. Welcome to the second session of the morning, and I'm very pleased to introduce Emily Greff from SOAS at the University of London, who's going to be talking about Indigenous language publishing in the North American context.
Thanks very much, and thank you all for being here, and thank you to ICLDC and the University of Hawaii for having me. This is based off of my master's dissertation at the SOAS University of London, which I submitted this past September. Just to let you know, I'm very new to the field, so if I make mistakes or have misunderstood anything, please do let me know. I appreciate the feedback. So, why publishing? First of all, you know, it is kind of a niche area for the field. Of course, in language revitalization, we want to focus on speakers and getting people speaking. However, my background is in publishing. I worked in publishing in New York City for 7 years in various roles, bookselling, editorial, literary agent. And of course, I've been a lifelong reader and a lover of books and reading. But also you see in language revitalization programs, there's a focus on developing literacy. But a lot of the time, that literacy doesn't really go beyond the educational domain, as Grenoble and Whaley went out in 2006. So there's always this problem of, okay, we're building literacy, we're learning how to read in our language, but then what is there to read? Lotta Homage and McCarty in 1997 kind of addresses, you know, building that literacy can validate the language, it can build prestige. But I was interested in looking at, okay, what is out there? What is there to read? Also, a lot of publishing comes about from linguists who want to give back to their community by creating books. A lot of the time it's grammars and dictionaries, but also sometimes storybooks. Books can also be a really important prestige factor, as we just heard in the last session with the dictionary project. It really elevates the status of the language, not just with dictionaries and grammars, but also if you have a storybook. And I think this is especially important in communities where you're embedded in a wider dominant language that has a rich literary tradition, especially as in North America, when you have English. You know, obviously the English literary tradition is wide and varied and vast. When you have so little in your own language, you can kind of, there can be this prestige question of like, is it worth writing in? Is it good enough to write in? But again, that can be contrasted with the importance of the oral transmission. So it is really a choice between communities, but something to consider, I think. And as Cross 9022 says, this can be very crucial symbolic value. Also, books can help with the preservation of language. And a lot of these books, print materials, have a lot of longevity. And can be really important in the documentation of the language. I mean, we have a lot of cases where languages have been able to be revitalized due to written materials, like Wampanoag in Massachusetts. Another reason I wrote this dissertation is because there's very little out there on publishing in Indigenous languages, and just the kind of publishing process in these language revitalization situations. One of the most important papers is Berner, 1997. He argues that for linguists who want to help preserve language diversity, there are, in my view, two best things to do. One is to help Native people develop more language nest programs. The other is to help Native people develop publishing houses. His argument is that literacy alone is not sufficient. It's also necessary to develop a literary tradition. This can foster pride in the language, as we've discussed, and confer economic benefits to writers in Indigenous languages. It also allows the language to compete with that dominant language, because again, when you're surrounded by all these other books and there's nothing else to read in your language, you're gonna prioritize literacy in the dominant language. And again, it can add to the documentation of the language. Why North America? Simply because I'm American and I needed to choose an area to look at. But it's also a really ideal case because you have this huge diversity of languages and cultures and communities within two larger nations. I think there are about 169 Indigenous languages spoken in the contiguous 48 states in Alaska, 60 Indigenous languages spoken in Canada. Lots of different approaches to language revitalization, but in terms of literacy and education, you have a single state funding body and education authority. Just as a side note, sorry Hawaii, I didn't include you in this study. Historically, the majority of these languages have been non in some languages that have been written for a long time, like Yupik, Cherokee, Navajo. However, the development of literacy and literature is relatively recent for a lot of these languages, especially compared to like European minority languages, Irish, Welsh, Catalan, which have a rich literary tradition, if not as vast as English. So that made it easier for me to analyze the development of literary traditions because it's so recent, and it was a lot less material to collect into a database. So, my main question that I want to look at is, what is the state of the art of indigenous language publishing in North America? What's out there? What do we have? What kinds of books are published in indigenous languages? What genres? What topics? Why are they published? Is it mainly for education? Do we have a sector that's for entertainment and personal edification? Or is it, you know, largely for academia? For whom are they published? Students? Children? Is there stuff out there for adults? Is it, or is the adult stuff mostly for non-indigenous academics and that happens to be accessible to by indigenous people? How are they published? Is it a lot of self-publication, commercial publishing houses? Are tribal authorities getting involved? Or is it a lot of academic presses? And finally, I want to explore a little bit about how the books that are out there might affect perceptions of language prestige. So how I went about this is that I built a database. Because I was from London, this had to be a lot of armchair research, unfortunately. So I used online resources. And the criteria I wanted to look at was, I wanted books that were written for entertainment or personal education. So I wanted books that you might look at a shelf, say, oh, that looks really cool, and pick it up and read it. So I didn't include textbooks. I didn't include dictionaries. I didn't include grammars or compendiums of place names. It needed to be something that was kind of like a narrative. They had to be discoverable on the internet because that's what I was looking for. And I also wanted to get books that were accessible. So, you know, putting myself in the shoes of a community member that might not be on their homelands, might not be as involved in the education or tribal authorities, they wanted to find a book in their language. Would they be able to get it? So that means, like, if like you find a book that was like written in the 60s and there's only like 2 used copies on Amazon for like $85, I didn't consider that accessible. What this means is that there are a lot of books in my database that are not there, because I know that there are a lot of education programs and tribes that have published books in language, but they only do so for a set number of people, distribute those books, don't keep it in print, or they don't publicize it, which is totally fine, but it means that they don't have it. However, I think that is a pretty comprehensive database, and even though it may not be exhaustive, it gives a good idea of what is out there and what is going on. In the end, I ended up with 2,260 titles across 102 languages. This will be available later, and you can find the database online. It's just a Google Doc, it's not fancy. Hopefully at some point I will be able to get something more interactive and accessible. Just quickly, this is the kind of information I collected. Title, publisher, year, publication, language, is it bilingual, is it monolingual, who is it for, what kind of genre, picture book, nonfiction, fiction, are they traditional stories or non-traditional, and then a bunch of other metadata. A lot of this data we're not going to get into for time reasons, but it's there if anybody ever needs it. So let's get into the data. Here we have by country. Canada has the most indigenous language books. About 1,800 titles compared to the U.S.'s 444, so that's a huge difference. That tiny yellow sliver, I don't know if you can see it, is my other category. That's just like there were 2 books published by the U.K. by an academic press, and then a couple books that were a joint publication between U.S. and Canada. Canada's got a lot of indigenous books, eh? I went to McGill, I can do that. So the reason that this is it's completely dominated by educational titles. And what I mean by that is these are books that are published by school boards, by education, educational groups, and they're meant for students. They're meant to teach the language, meant to teach literacy. Examples of this are the Cree School Board. They have a great website at eastcree.org, the Saskatchewan Indigenous Cultural Center, South Slave Divisional Education Council, and I'm not going to try to pronounce this word, but it's a Mohawk Education Resource Center. About 1,320 titles are educational titles, 73%, which is a huge, huge amount. So, I mean, already we can see a lot of the stuff that's out there is definitely for education purposes for children and a very basic level of reading. Just zooming out, the combined US and Canada breakdown is about 66% educational books are published by Canada and 34% are published in the US. In terms of genre, a lot of these, most of them, 64%, are early readers. And I'll get to what I mean by that in a minute. Only 17% are picture books, 11% are nonfiction, and then we have a few books that fall into the other category, kind of like board books and workbooks, and then folklore, which I consider to be books that are not quite early readers, but don't really have the illustrations of picture books either. And they're conveying traditional stories. Not the best term, but shorthand. So what I mean by early reader, this is a book by the Little Cree Publications. It's an ebook. So as you can see, like, the text is pretty big, not a lot of words on the page, and the illustration is just kind of like there. It's very, this is what's going on in the story, but not a lot of focus on the art. Whereas picture books, on the other hand, very much rely on pictures to tell the story, and they're a part of the whole experience. You can have a lot more text. A lot of the time, picture books are meant to be read to children rather than read by children, though of course older children can read them once they have the literacy skills. And finally, that was by Inhabit Media, by the way, in a note to this is what I consider to be a nonfiction book for children. This is Abloo Hunting, also by Inhabit Media, in an Inuktitut. And as you can see, it's got a great deal more text, but it focuses on like photographs rather than illustrations and tells the story of like, here's how we hunt seals. Very factual. So what we have in terms of non-educational books is a lot less, only about 700-something titles. Again, Canada dominates with 486 titles. The USA has only 241. By non-educational books, I mean mostly books that are not published, that are published by more commercial publishers or self-publishers, not these educational groups that are producing stuff specifically for school environments. In terms of audience, again, huge focus on youth. So a lot of children, middle readers, a few young adult books, and like less than 200 titles for adults in my database. And then a few for that kind of fall into that weird area where it's all ages. In terms of genre, for youth titles, it's mostly picture books. Some early readers, not as much as in educational situations. Some board books, which are those really thick books that babies cannot destroy. So a few more nonfiction and then a few others. In terms of adult books, a lot of it is nonfiction, a lot of it is folklore, again, these traditional stories. And most of this is published by academic presses, and a lot of the time, they're not really published with Indigenous people in mind. They're for scholars and academics, so they have parallel texts where you have, on one page, the Indigenous language, on the other, a direct translation. Just as a side note, I didn't include books that had the interlinear glosses because I didn't think that that was super accessible for Indigenous people to read. You need a little bit of training to get through that. There's also some poetry, which is a genre that is really accessible, especially for second language learners that are just starting to write in their language. And memoirs, again, you know, these are all collected, for the most part, from oral texts and then written down and transliterated. So, one of the biggest difference I found between the educational and non-educational books is the format. Is it monolingual or bilingual? For the most part, the educational books are monolingual, which I found really encouraging because, you know, there have been studies done where if you have a bilingual text and the child is already literate in a dominant language, they're not going to get as much from the bilingual text. They're just going to focus on the English rather than the target language. So that's great for an educational context, of course. Non-educational books, however, tend to be more bilingual. This is for a variety of reasons. Some, I think, more commercial publishers want to make it accessible. So they say, oh, okay, like, you have these people who don't read the language at all, aren't really community members, but they are interested in the culture and they're interested in learning more about the world. So you have to have, like, bilingual text so that it's accessible to people who aren't community members, which can be good for your bottom line in terms of publishing and making money. But again, you run into that problem of prioritizing the target language, the indigenous language. This is just for your own enjoyment. These are the languages that are best represented in my database. In terms of books, Cree by far dominates. There's a lot of support for Cree programs in Canada, from what I've seen. Of course, community members may beg to differ. And then a lot of Northern Athabascan languages, Ojibwe, Eskimo, Aleut, and Navajo, of course, in the States. Although I have 102 languages represented in my database, there are quite a few languages that only have one title. If you see the note at the bottom, like 26 of my languages only have a single title to their name. So, what is the state of the art of Indigenous language publishing? For the most part, majority of titles are published in Canada. They're published by educational publishers for use in a school setting, and they're for children. Of those titles produced by non-educational publishers, still 72.5% are aimed at children. And picture books make up the majority of these titles. They also have the best representation across languages. So 49 languages have at least one picture book in their language. What few adult titles exist are primarily traditional stories or nonfiction, oral narratives that have been compiled by linguists and published by university presses. And then of course the monolingual, bilingual divide. So why is this important? I think that books are really prestigious cultural objects. Even in English, people you don't associate with reading and, you know, culture, like Snooki and Donald Trump, have published books because it's prestigious, it's important, it raises the status of a person or a language. Books are an opportunity to use and maintain Indigenous literacy. If you don't have these titles that are aimed at older children and adults, I think maybe the motivation to maintain literacy could decline. But also, a wide and varied literature can engage and inspire second language learners. I know, as somebody who has loved books and loved languages all my life, you know, I love picking up books in other languages as kind of an aspirational thing. You know, I can't quite read this level of French yet, but I can look in the dictionary and I can learn. As Brenner 1997 says, books can document and preserve languages, provide economic incentives, although we'll get back to that in a minute. And obviously, books are timeless, and they're relatively low maintenance. You have a lot of apps out there, software programs, video games, but they require maintenance, and technology can go obsolete. So if you don't have, you know, you're not constantly updating your technology, you don't have the constant funding for that, sometimes it can fall by the wayside. But books are stable. Even if you don't keep a book in print, you can always do print on demand. So if you print like 1,000 copies and that's it, you can still keep it available on Lulu or Amazon or CreateSpace or whatever, and people who might want it in the future can have accessibility. Especially with today's technology, it's a lot easier to do. Of course, creating an Indigenous language books is much easier said than done, not even getting into the problem of orthography, which is a whole giant kettle of fish. The economic incentives that Brenner, 1997, argues for are hard to come by in smaller communities when you just don't have enough people who might want to buy the books, let alone write them. Funding, obviously, is a huge problem. How can this be overcome? I think that there can be a lot of more experimentation with models and a lot more collaboration happening. Some models I have here, Indigenous owned presses in Canada, for example, Nimbus Publishing, Gabriel Demont Institute, they publish primarily English language books of Indigenous interests and some Indigenous language books as well. So like one is kind of subsidizing the other. Similarly, Inhabit Media, who published primarily in Inuktitut, you saw some of their examples earlier, they do two editions, which is great. A hardcover in English for mainstream audiences that's distributed throughout Canada and the US by mainstream distributors. You know, and they have write-ups in all the trade magazines, it's great. And they do a paperback in Inuktitut, so one again, one is subsidizing the other. Selena Bookshelf, they publish in Navajo, they do bilingual books so that the titles are accessible to mainstream audiences. And then there's other ways of doing things, like Edwards 2007 advocates for a co-publishing model for picture books, wherein they had a translation, many different translations of one book that wasn't indigenous in nature at all. It was like a bunch of coconuts or something. And they did like multiple translations. And the way that they print picture books is that they do the illustrations first, so all the color ink, and then after that they can do the black and white text. So that means that these different groups can share the costs, and with a larger print run, the cost goes way down and makes it way more affordable. And I think in the next session we'll also learn a bit more about some creative solutions to publishing. And yeah, so concluding remarks. In Louise Erdrich's book, Books and Islands in Ojibwe Country, she has this refrain, books, why? And she has many different answers. One man she encountered started a library because, you know, books can bring health and wealth and sobriety to the community. Books open doors, books broaden horizons. One quote that really stuck with me as I was writing my dissertation was Ader 2005 in his prestige planning paper, was that using the language should be regarded as something attractive, something that has some enthusiasm to fire the imagination. And books, for me, and I think a lot of people, are something that fire the imagination, that get you motivated, that get you inspired. As we've discussed, literary traditions can help build prestige, elevate the status of the language, engage learners and speakers, and preserve the language. As we've seen, like a few languages have a really good start on building a body of literature, but I think we have a long way to go in terms of getting it outside the domain of education. And there are lots of challenges, but I think there can be creative solutions as well. And that's everything. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. So we have 10 minutes for questions.
And I absolutely agree, like literacy has many different terms or meanings, especially in this day and age. One of the better arguments that I didn't quite get into in this presentation is that if people are writing in their indigenous language, they can write in a way that is outside of the Western tradition, outside of the majority language tradition, or English tradition rather, and better convey indigenous ideas and traditions. So that's another benefit to writing in indigenous languages. Oh yes, I have lots and lots of ink actually in my database for sure.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And do you know also that there was a publisher, general publisher, who published bilingual poetry?
Yes, Edition.
Mémoire d'un Privé.
I'm not sure if I have that one, but I do have some poetry.
I just wanted to
yes,
sure
yes.
No.
Yes, for sure. Yeah, there's some really great stuff coming out of Inu, for sure.
Literacy for what? The it literacy in English and in world languages, the older you are, the more books there are to read.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just the opposite in
yeah.
in native languages at this point, that we are, well, native people are learning literacy in school,
mm-hmm.
and then there's a cutoff.
Yeah.
There's nothing to read when you grow up.
Exactly.
And that's always been an issue that's troubled me.
Yeah, and I think, you know, arguing, of course, that we need to have more books for people who are older than 8. But, I mean, of course, people can also use literacy and or writing, reading and writing on their own, especially in today's environment when a lot of people are texting, they're on a computer. I don't know, I mean, I haven't looked at this as much in like terms of like how people are using their indigenous languages in those contexts. But I think, you know, having stuff to read does encourage more writing and more reading and more self-expression in that, in indigenous languages in that way.
And then the question is that you, you're obviously aware, said you are, that there's a lot of sort of lower level publication.
Yeah, kind of below the radar.
And it's probably much more gigantic
mm-hmm.
than what you've been able to find. And I'm wondering if you plan to do any studies of maybe particular languages, the unpublished publishing.
Yeah. I would love to. Unfortunately, I'm not currently planning on doing a doctorate at this time. What I actually would love to do is, you know, help facilitate the publishing of material in indigenous language, so kind of move out of the academic sphere and into kind of just like hands-on getting things done and helping people do that. But if anybody else wants to do that, I would love to help
I'm
that.
I'm sorry, but you, early on you said, the list can be found here.
Yes, there's a link.
Here could be a website.
Yes, I am. that is a link to my Google document. I don't know if it will actually work. Let me click on it. Yes, I definitely want to go there. I'll talk about it while it's maybe coming up. Anyway, that here link, which I'm gonna make this available to ICLDC, just goes to a Google document. Thanks. And it's like it's the raw database. It's kind of hard to get through. But I am planning on building a website that will make it more accessible. When I was building the database, the University of Toronto Library had a huge number of resources, especially for Canadian titles, and that was so helpful when I was building my database, but then when I started to get into the U.S. stuff, there was just, like, nothing. I was scouring. I was literally Googling, like, 500 language names. Oh, here he is. going, like, okay, Navajo language books, Navajo books, and trying to find things that way, which is extremely time-consuming. So I want to make something so that people can find that. But yeah, this is what it looks like, as you can see. If anybody wants to look up a particular language, we can do that.
For us, we have a number of the ones that sort of use within our immersion school, but we never have the money to do it, to go any further.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on ebooks, and where would you suggest that we go to at least to get it more accessible to people without having to do a printed form?
So, I mean, ebooks are great. I do include ebooks in my database. Wasn't able to get into the whole binding and all that in my talk, unfortunately. But I think, as you mentioned earlier, like sometimes you don't have an internet connection, or if it's not a downloadable ebook, that can be hard to access. I've also seen a few examples where they have an ebook available, but it's in a format that I had never heard of before. And you have to download special software, and that can be a barrier. But yeah, I think ebooks are great, and getting them up there and out there and, you know, publicizing it is a good idea. The other thing is that there are print-on-demand services where you don't have to pay anything upfront. You can just put your format up there. And people, they have to pay if they want a print copy. Of course, you do get into some issues of accessibility if you want to restrict it. If you don't want people who are not part of the community to get those books, then it's not as good of an option, but it is available. I think a lot of new books actually are through lulu.com, which is great. Another question? Yes. I think it would be a great thing. I think that is definitely something that community members have to decide on their own. There is one book that is not in my database, but I thought was a tremendous example, is a Cherokee translation of Charlotte's Web that an elder produced. And again, they did a very small print run, sent just to the community members. Robert Munch, who is a very beloved Canadian picture book author, has given a blanket license to First Nations peoples to translate his books and publish them in their languages. So I think it's a great, I mean, if you're looking for material and you don't quite have the people who are willing and ready to make books on their own steam, but you have translators who are willing to do that work, it can be a great way. But again, because they're not gonna be books, or they're not necessarily gonna be books of indigenous, based indigenous culture, you know, it's a choice that people have to make. Although on that note, you know, there is a great indigenous literary tradition in English. There are so many great authors like Louise Erdrich, Sharon Alexie, Tim Tingle. I think it would be really powerful to see their books in their languages.
Go ahead. This question.
This is kind of great to see. I mean, we always search for books, and like you said, they're all one word and picture in the top.
Yeah.
And a book is like a friend, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You keep going back to it all the time. And when you read it one day, you go back again, you'll see something totally different or pick up on another thing that's just so great. And yeah, it's kind of neat to know that there is at least we know what's out there.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I have just one question, if
sure.
I may. And it addresses in part the point that Leanne raised. Do you include a genre of autobiography?
Yeah, it has memoir as my genre, which includes autobiography, because I didn't want to break it down because they're so close together.
Okay.
So memoir includes autobiography.
Because I know that at least a couple. I mean, one in Innu, Je suis une maudite sauvagesse,
mm-hmm.
which is in Innu and in French,
yeah.
and then another one in Inuit, which are definitely adult reading at the top
mm-hmm.
of that pinnacle, and they're extraordinary literary works.
Yes, definitely.
In their own
they're
genre.
Definitely in there.
Great.
So yeah, it was very encouraging to see those titles, and I'd love to see more of that out there for people to, you know, connect with their members of the community and their ancestors. So
yes, that's it.
Okay.
Their cultural history and
mm-hmm.
their identity.
Definitely, and the history as
yeah.
well.
Okay. Thank you very. Oh, sorry.
If you wanted to complete with the book, Je suis une maudite sauvagesse, this book was not to be written. It was not transcription of oral. History.
Mm-hmm.
So that woman, she wrote two books, and it's what really hit up. It was something very special in Inuit because it's an oral tradition language.
Yeah.
But she really wrote that. She started writing. So
yes.
It's something that you don't find very often.
Yeah, definitely. Especially with the adult language level books.
Yeah. Or some of Ophelia Zepeda's work, things like that too. Which is. Thank you very much.
Thank you
very
much.